I checked at the University of Alberta. They wouldn't take me. I was too old. Checked at the Banff School program. Wouldn't take me. Too old. Jeez. Checked at the National Art School. Wouldn't take me. Too old. I thought, how am I going to get an education? So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go to New York.
And off to New York she went. That's Susan Gilmore, a singer and actress who went from performing on a cruise ship as a Broadway girl to actually performing on Broadway, playing Fantine in Les Misérables. And while a lot of us dream of making the move to New York City to study or work, Susan was one of the few who made that dream come true. Her story, and it's an inspiring one, includes the time she was fired and got kicked off a cruise ship, great story, to flying first class around the world playing Fantine. Hey, it's Keith Tomasek. Thanks so much for listening to my podcast, The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. Brought to you by StratfordFestivalReviews.com. Hey, and thanks so much for all your feedback about the last episode with Kim's convenience creator, Inns Choi. That's a TV show right now, Kim's Convenience. It's on CBC, and it's doing so well. And I was so pleased and honored to be able to interview Inns and find out all about his youth and growing up and writing the play backstage. Anyway, play that became a TV show. I got an email from Gerald in Halifax I just wanted to share with you. And by the way, if you want to send me an email, just visit theinadequatelife.com. All the info is there. Gerald writes, thanks for your interview with Inns Choi. I hadn't heard of him or the play. Well, Gerald, that's why I'm here. Prior to your podcast, my only source of comedy with a touch of Korea was Margaret Cho. I'm loving the TV show and can't wait to see the play Kim's Convenience at the Neptune Theater here in Halifax in January. Do you know if Inns or any other actors from the TV show will be in Halifax? Good question, Gerald. I don't know. Sorry. All right. I'll look into it, though. And I'll get back to you on the email or Twitter. Now, before we get to Susan Gilmore, I want to thank my sponsors, Ellipsis Digital, digital strategy for creatives by creatives. And I just read a post on the Ellipsis Digital blog, and the post is called SEO tips for web developers, search engine optimization tips for web developers. And hey, these days, everyone thinks they know something about SEO. And if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know, I teach social media at Western University, and that kind of stuff's important to me. So the tips on the blog, right on the money. And the first one about creating websites that render quickly on all formats is key. You'll find all the tips on the blog at ellipsis.digital. My other sponsor, Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. And I was in Stratford last week, so I dropped by. Man, she is busy. She is busy. And the store is going through a redesign. But the tea remains the same, as exotic and as fresh as ever. If you're in Stratford, drop by or just visit StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Never too early to start thinking about Christmas shopping, because she can just mail the tea to anyone, anywhere. It's perfect. And finally, the Bruce Hotel, Stratford's most luxurious and well-appointed hotel, who kindly let me use a room to interview Susan. So, what an interview. Like, she's so open and so candid. She shares the story of her path from a young kid singing pop and folk music to playing Fantine on Broadway. Incidentally, Susan is currently in Footloose at the Dunfield Theatre in Cambridge, and she'll also be appearing in Sister Act, which runs from late November to early December at the Dunfield. Here comes our chat. So here we are just at the Bruce Hotel, just a little bit outside of
the beautiful Bruce Hotel.
Isn't it nice? And you could walk to the Festival Theatre from here.
I know.
So, which is where you performed for many years. I want to talk about some of the work you did there. I was looking through the reviews and I found this wonderful review of Into the Woods, which was directed by Peter Hinton. Mm-hmm. And this is what Christopher Hoyle wrote on Stage Door. No musical has been staged at the Avon Theater with so much imagination since the Susan Benson, Brian McDonald, Gilbert and Sullivan operettas of the 1980s. Hoyle loved your performance of Last Midnight and said it drew shivers in his spine.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. Oh, what a great review.
So talk a bit about that time and that production. And Bruce Dow, he's been on the podcast, and mm-hmm. he spoke some quite deeply and honestly about some of the struggles he was going through. Tell me about where you were at in your career at that time in Stratford.
I was so happy just to get an audition, because often it's difficult to get an audition. And I had never worked with Peter Hinton before, and I'd heard so many great things about him. And I prepared really well for it, and I went in and did my audition, and and just came out of there flying. And I was just so happy to play that incredible role of the witch and Into the Woods. And it was a huge challenge. And I've been very blessed in my life by playing great leading lady roles.
Yeah.
And so this was one I'd always wanted to play. And the concept of our show was so different than the Broadway concept. And it was edgy and it was dark. And yet it still held all the real messages of the piece, and about people and about heart and soul and about belief systems and the weaknesses in people and the strengths in people. And it deals with so many things.
And as an actress coming into that audition, did you have a sense of what Hinton's interpretation was going to be? And if not, how did you then adjust your take on the role based on that approach?
Yeah, I had no idea. I was assuming that we were going to do the Broadway version, I guess. I try not to assume anything. So what I do is I just learn my stuff as solidly as I can and then leave myself open to direction at the audition. So he was able to say, well, okay, that was great. Try it this way. And, oh, try it. Add a little this to that. Okay, I want to know how you're feeling when you say that, you know. And so he worked with me, and right. I was able to just go with the flow and give him everything I possibly could. And so working with Peter as a director, too, was very exciting because he worked through every thought, every beat, he questioned every phrase you spoke, everything you sang, and he was able to pull stuff out of you or make you think outside the box in some ways too, which a great director does.
Yeah.
And I'm an actor that needs a good director. I have a lot of great instincts, but I love to have a good director too, to help me push out the sides of the envelopes that I live in, you know.
Of course.
And as actors, that's what we want to do.
Yeah. So I want to go back though to the very beginning, because according to something that you wrote in your yearbook, and I might have this wrong, but the research shows, you wrote in your yearbook, I want to sing, this is when you were a kid, I want to sing, I want to be happy, I want to travel, and you've had a chance to do all of that. Like, it's quite something in high school.
It absolutely is. When I wrote that, it was just, you know, I was a crazy 18-year-old going, wow, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And I had just started singing in a duo with a friend of mine in school, Carmen Walsh, her name is. And we used to write songs and sing, and we became this folk duo. And we did Joni Mitchell, and we did Joan Baez, and we did, you know, the Eagles when they came along. We just did everything we could from soup to nuts. And I went to Grant McEwen Music College in the jazz vocal program. And one day I was singing and the door was open and I was singing, you know, my song that was, you know, my turn to sing. And when the class was over, I came out of the door and there was this handsome man standing in the hallway. And he said, Susan Gilmore. And I said, yeah. And he said, hello, how do you do? My name's Morse Fritz. And I'm putting together a show to go over to entertain the UN peacekeeping forces in Israel, Cyprus, and Germany.
I did one of those tours.
Did you?
That's hilarious. So go on, sorry.
I was like 19 years old. I'd never been anywhere. And I said, oh my goodness, I would love to do that.
So just because you mentioned Grant McEwen, yeah. So you studied at Grant McEwen at Edmonton. Then you went to the Edmonton Musical Theater. Yes. Then you decided to go to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy in New York City.
Yeah, well, yeah. What happened was I knew that I met Dasha Goody, who was the founder of Edmonton Musical Theater, and she heard me singing in a band that I had. I was singing a bar mitzvah or something, and she waltzed by me with her husband and slipped a little piece of paper at my feet, and which said, "Come and see me. I'm at table 159," and she was like one of the teachers at Grant McEwen mm-hmm. when I was there. So. She said, I'm doing this Edmonton Musical Theater program. And she said, I think you'd be wonderful in it. Come down and see what we're doing on Monday night and see if it's something that resonates with you. So I said, okay. So I went and I went, oh my God, this is what I want to do. And, you know, I was in my mid-20s by then. I kind of realized I wasn't going to be a pop star. And so, I thought, okay, I'm going to reinvent myself. I think this is something I could really do, because I had sung everything from rock and roll to pop to jazz to top 40 to anything really except opera. And I thought, well, the way musical theater was at that time in the 80s, it was getting quite poppy. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there's a place for me there.
Sure. Yeah.
So I just checked at the University of Alberta. They wouldn't take me. I was too old. Checked at the Banff School Program. Wouldn't take me. Too old.
Jeez.
Checked at the National Art School. Wouldn't take me. Too yeah. old. I thought, how am I going to get an education? So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go to New York. So I started checking the schools in New York, and I sent some applications and resumes and a little tape of some of the stuff I'd recorded. And I had no musical theater background at all at that point, just what I did with Emmett Musical Theater. And and I got accepted at American Musical Drama. Well, they said, come down and audition for us, is what they said.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just packed my bags as though I was going to be there, and auditioned one morning, and they said, bless you.
Thanks.
And they said, why do you want to come to this school? And I said, well, because I want to learn. I'm coming to this a little bit late, and I want to learn everything I can. And I came to New York because this is the place to do it. So that's why. And so they accepted me, and I studied there for 2.5 years and got my diploma, and
that's something.
Had an amazing time.
Yeah, to take off. Now, I've interviewed folks on the podcast who, Canadians, who have made that transition to go to New York. Did you, after you did the program, try to live in New York at that point? Did you say?
I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a thing, you have a visa, and you can extend your visa for a year if you're trying to work in the genre that you were studying.
Oh, that's under. Good. Yeah.
But the trick is you have to apply within 30 days of graduating, which I did.
Gotcha.
And then you have to wait 90 days to hear
if you get it.
Yeah. And they give you a number to call if after 90 days you don't get it. So anyway, to make a long story short, I got a job on a cruise ship going out of L.A. to Mexico. And we were out 9 days and back and back and back and back. And every time I got into L.A., I'd phone the number to see if, nothing. And finally, it was getting very close to the 90-day period. And I called this other number, and I got a lawyer to do a trace on it for me to find out what happened. And he said, well, I found your check. It got cashed, but there's no trace of your application. So I didn't get my, I couldn't get it. And I couldn't reapply because it was after 30 days. And so when I got off the cruise ship, unbeknownst to me, every 9 days, because you check into LA and out again, it's like being in the States.
Right.
So I had been in the States, according to them, longer than my 6-month stay as a visitor. And when I got off the ship, they literally grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and took me to the airport and put me on a plane.
Man.
For home. And I couldn't come back for 8 months or something.
Wow.
And in that time, I started auditioning and getting work in Canada. And so I went,
surprise.
I'll just stay here.
Oh, good for her. That's wild. So that's a fascinating New York story, because it's not like you had to leave New York because there was no room for you in New York.
No.
You got out of there and then did the, and it's just sort of
it's
paperwork.
It's like a big boot came down to the sky, out of the sky, and went, boot, you're not meant to be there. Go home. So home I went, and I've had an amazing career.
Home to Edmonton or home to?
Home to Edmonton first, because I had no money. And
yeah. Wait a sec. You're on a cruise ship. You don't spend money on a cruise ship. What were you doing with your money?
Okay, this is what happened on the cruise ship, and you can put this out there or not, but I'll just tell you anyway quickly. when I signed my contract to do the cruise ship, they said, if you get fired from the cruise ship, you have to pay for the person who is replacing you. You have to pay for their costumes. You have to pay for the rehearsal time. And I said, what do you have to do to get
fired?
And they said, well, the last guy that got fired got caught running stoned on drugs, naked, down the hallway. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that.
Fine.
So
yeah.
I signed. And there's a rule on the cruise ship at the line that I was on then. I won't say what line it was. And that said, if you cannot fraternize with anybody on the ship that works on the ship. You can fraternize with the officers.
Right. Oh, that's
you
convenient.
Can fraternize with the passengers. Part of our duty was to dance with passengers in the disco and all that stuff. Yeah. And I was doing fashion shows. I was doing a million things on that ship. They make you work hard. But one night, my roommate was the girl that I was sharing a room with was having an affair with the guy that worked in the theater. And of course, I don't know how they got away with it, but they were in the room and I couldn't go in. So I went up to the pool area just to sit and sort of read a book. And the first, group of people going down for dinner were gone. And so there was really hardly anyone up there and the sun was going down. And this, deck steward, who I'd sort of befriended, like just, he's much younger than me and just as a friend, was standing there and I wasn't going to talk to him. And but he was starting to fold up
the chairs
and taking towels. And so I thought I'd help him. So I'm just folding up chairs and taking towels. And we're going into this huge closet in and out of this closet, picking up chairs and towels. And at one point we were both in the closet and, in walks the captain, the chief purser, all these officers. What's going on in here? And they could see instantly nothing was going on. And they all kind of laughed and said, okay, well, go to your room and get ready for dinner. And then 10 minutes later, there's a knock on the door and it's this deck steward. And he says, I've been fired. I said, what? No way. And I said, I'm going to go talk to you. And so I stormed upstairs and demanded to see the captain, and he wouldn't see me. And I was just so frustrated because it was just ridiculous.
Yeah, this is very bizarre.
And so I went to dinner and because I had to, because I was sitting with this group of people.
Oh, part of your job.
Part of my job. Yeah. And then halfway through dinner, I get a tap on my shoulder and it's the chief purser. And I said, oh, good. Can I see the captain? And he goes, no. And he beckons me out the door and he says, you're being fired.
Jeez.
And I went, what? For what? And he goes, I know it's ridiculous, but the vice president of the line is coming on to enforce rules. And he saw you go in and out and he saw him go in and out. He didn't know you were one of the Broadway girls. Yeah, yeah. And he said, so he fired my friend and
the guy.
And
meanwhile, your other friend is getting it on with someone in the room while you're upstairs.
I know.
That's really
lots
bad
of that
karma.
Was going on, but I just happened to be the one, right?
You're completely innocent.
Completely. And I mean, I wish I had done something now, but anyway.
Of course. That's awful.
But when he found out that I was one of the Broadway girls, he wanted to set an example.
Oh, sure.
So 2 days later, there. Lorenzo and I are standing on the docks in LA,
yeah.
And all the money I'd saved has gone to go to my replacement.
Right.
And so I came home literally.
You literally had nothing.
No money, yeah. A little cocktail dress.
Right.
A couple of pairs of shorts, 3 bikinis.
That's hilarious.
And it was like January in Edmonton. I'm back in my old bedroom and at home in my parents' house. Feeling like an going from top of my class in New York
yeah.
Going and with my dreams of becoming a Broadway star,
sure.
And to this utter failure, and I was a mess for a little while.
How long?
3 or 4 months, maybe.
Okay.
And yeah. Then in the spring, I pulled myself together and put together the hottest band Edmonton had, called the Susan Gilmore Band, and we played all the clubs. And
so pop music covers?
Or? Oh, absolute. All pop music covers.
After you'd spent 2.5 years studying musical theater.
I needed to move forward energetically in the field that I know, or I knew anyway.
Yeah.
And then I heard about the auditions. A friend of mine that used to play piano for Edmonton Musical Theater said, have you heard about the Les Mis auditions? And I went, oh, are they coming to Canada? And because I didn't even know I'd been on
cruise ship. Right, you've been out of the loop for so long.
I know. And he helped me prepare for that. And I went, and the auditions were being held in Calgary.
So at this point, had you done any like long form musical theater? Had you been in a, no, you hadn't been,
nothing.
You studied it. So you did some in school perhaps, but you never in a whole beginning to end.
No,
that's
nothing.
That's wild, eh? So let me ask you, going back, so how much did that work you did as the Susan Gilmore Band, just rocking it out in the clubs, you think, how much did that help you do so well in the auditions, or did it at all, do you think?
All of it did. All of it did.
Yeah, I bet.
It all did, because, well, and also the training I had in New York,
of course,
because we did audition courses there too, and how to. But I had certain amount of confidence in my voice, and I knew what I was doing, and I Dreamed a Dream was quite... quite poppy in a way.
You did it at the Royal Alexandra, and that's then right. You went to Broadway. Then you were in Los Angeles. You toured mm-hmm. Singapore, Korea, mm-hmm. Cape Town, South Africa, Hong Kong. So I was reading something, and you were talking about the Princess of Wales production, which you became Fantine in and were there for quite a while. You said, normally after 6 or 8 weeks, I'd be ready to move on to something else. I think it's maybe because the story is so strong and I have such an emotional connection to it that I'm still able to go out there every night as though it's the first time and see it through the end. So that's fascinating that, mm-hmm. that you knew enough about yourself that after about 6 or 8 weeks, you might get bored. But what is it about Les Mis and Fantine, do you think that made that emotional connection for you, that made it so exciting night after night?
I guess... Well, first of all, the production itself and the story is a classic story. Sure. Yeah. And each character that the book talks about is well-rounded and I felt the musical was too. So the musical was not a boring story. It was very detailed and followed the classic story very well. And Fantine's part was so rich that and my own imagination was so ready to do it and rich that I just can, just my soul, there's something in my soul that really connected with Fantine, with her plight, with her story, with her struggle, and also being in the wrong place at the wrong time and having her life be changed,
right?
Which kind of just happened to me when I got kicked out of the States. And of course, so even though it's not the same story, it is a similar feeling. And so you do understand how you are left to deal and pick up the pieces after something happens in your life and try to move forward. Now, in Fantine's case, it was a very sad story. Mm-hmm. And although she tried, but things did work out for her because in the way for her, because all she cared about was her child.
Of course, yeah.
And then Valjean promises on her deathbed to take care of her child. And so there's just something really lovely about that. There's so much heart and soul in the story. And
well, just to go on to that, the moment there when she passes away, mm-hmm. that her death in the play is different from the original text. In the play, Fantine dies peacefully in the hospital with Jean Valjean at her side, and she trusts him to take care of Cosette. But I was reading through some of the text, and in the original text, Javert does tell her of Jean Valjean's true identity. And that happens in this, you know, heated scene, and there's tension, and mm-hmm. the tension and the trembling Fantine dies in a not a peaceful way at all. Mm-hmm. It was sort of in the original text, it's sort of not terrifying, but it's not a peaceful
and
death.
It's unresolved.
Right, yeah. So mm-hmm. talk a bit about playing such an iconic death scene.
In her death scene, it's all about seeing her daughter and trying to reach her daughter. And at that time in my life, I had not seen anyone die. So I had to use my imagination and draw, you know, from... But the story itself just took me
sure.
there.
But I love that point you made about at that point in your life not having seen someone die. And even when I was studying theater and we were talking about, you know, dealing with grief, no one in my life had died. Like I had never been to a funeral. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so mm-hmm. I just couldn't even imagine mm-hmm. how horrible it would have been. But you managed to get there.
Yeah. I could imagine being a mother and knowing that, I mean, it was a hard world they lived in, mm-hmm. and doing everything I could to protect my daughter, and I could imagine what it must have felt like to. I mean, I don't even know if she knew she was dying. All I know is that she saw her daughter, and was reaching yeah. for her until the very end, you know?
Like, right now you're doing this for me and you're back on stage. It's fascinating to watch you. Like, it's so, how many years did you do that for? Like, it's so in you. It's a part of you. How long did you
do
that for?
Well, I did it, I came to it in 1990. So I did 90, 91, part of 92. And then I went to LA with it. And then... I went to Broadway with it in 94, right. which I was invited to do Broadway, which I was just ecstatic
amazing,
about.
Amazing. Yeah.
And to have a Broadway credit is just a dream
huge.
Come true.
Well, an award winner in Los Angeles as mm-hmm, well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think all that singing I did in my youth telling the stories, telling the folk story, you know, like sure, Joan Baez, great, and they're all very picture, storytelling things that and make you go, okay, here's an idea, and how am I,
that's
and
so how funny. Am I going to... The concept of an idea in a song that's politically interesting or moving or...
Sure.
I think that's not quite as common now in pop music, I don't think.
Well, it is in a different way.
I suppose,
But...
Anyway, that's it. What you're saying is exactly the 101. Just be in the moment. And then you were able to catch it and feel like it was fresh every time. Was there anything in the period of your training in New York when that light went on? You thought, okay, now I can
absolutely
do this?
I worked with a woman by the name of Karen Gustafson. She had a class on musical theater presentation or something, where she talked about, you know, when you which I already understood, but she sort of broke it down and about every thought, every moment. Who are you? Where are you? Where did you just come from? Where are you going? Why are you saying what you're saying? Who are you saying it to? What does it mean? What's the subtext? So you're saying this, but what are you really saying? You know, turn your light on. Turn your light on. Don't do anything by rote, and don't move your arms without any meaning. If you move your arm, that means something. Don't just flail your arms around. Like she worked with all of us, and she was incredible. I put a lot on what I learned from her into my ability to transform that into performing.
Yeah.
That to make sense, to tell a story, to have that thought before you tell a story.
And at the time when she was giving it to you, did you know it was so important, or was it only later that you realized?
No, I knew instantly because we did it in front of each other. Mm. And so you see it.
Right. When
you see them get up and perform and you think, okay, well, that was good. And then she works with them. And then it's like, oh my God, that's so different and so much clearer. And then you get it.
Yeah.
It's a skill.
The last question about Fantine, because the character of a saved and saintly prostitute goes back. Well, she became a prostitute. That goes back to Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Dickens. Mm-hmm. What did you do as an actress to make that part fresh?
Well, just it happened so quickly on the stage that you did have to.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You had to go from the Fantine in the factory to the song "I Dreamed a Dream," which still had very different from the movie, by the way. Mm-hmm. Still had hope in it because she didn't know where she was going from there. She knew that she was ruined, and then the way that the show is constructed, where she gets pulled in by the whores, and she goes, no, I don't want to, I can't do that, I won't do that, and so she sells her hair, and then she sells her jewelry, and she sells her clothes, and she sells her teeth, and she does everything to not be that person until finally she cannot do anything else. And so because of the way the show is constructed, you do have those steps of degradation or that
transition,
happen transition that help you fall solidly into those places and again you use your imagination, you know, if I was, how would I feel when I had to have my teeth taken out of my face? How would I feel when
you're scaring me now?
You know, but
no,
I can't. True.
She's doing the part. I can't. I wish my listeners were here to watch what you're doing just with your face and your body. I'm like, oh my God, I have like a royal command performance here.
No,
it's serious.
But it's the truth. That's what we do.
Well,
right?
you're just bringing it up instantly. It's amazing. It's amazing. So, okay, so. And it's been intimidating to be right in front of it this close, you know?
Like, oh, dear.
No, seriously, it's really cool. So, okay, well, so I get you there. So let's move away to the life side of things. So let's start out with the international tour, because you did Les Mis all over the world, and a tour can be super physically demanding, to say nothing about doing the show every night in different houses and adapting and customs and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could go back to the time right before the tour began and gave the young Susan Gilmore some advice about going on tour, what advice would you give that young Susan Gilmore?
That's a good question. 'Cause going on that tour and being away for that long was an incredible experience. Every single moment of it. And if I had to go back and do it again, I wouldn't change a thing. But it took a toll on my marriage. It took a toll. Mostly, I guess, on my marriage, because I have the complete support of my family. I think they all missed me and everything, but it was a huge adventure. And
how long were we out for?
Almost a year.
Yeah. And how long had you been married before you went out?
We got married in 94, and this was 96, so four years.
So that's really new into the relationship.
5, 6, 2 years.
Yeah, very, very new into the relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we kind of got back on track when I got home for a little while. So, but I guess... It's hard to say. What advice would I give that girl? I'd probably just say, just pack your bags, girl, and go, because life is short. And to have the opportunity to see the world, different cultures, different food, different stars.
I totally get you.
Everything. Yeah, yeah. When are you going to get a chance to do that? Yeah. And also, this was a really Cadillac tour. For me, now looking back, I would say just go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
If I had not,
because it's life changing.
It's life changing, and although it did take a toll on my marriage, which was very sad, most of that had nothing to do with me. So, because I did everything I could to stay in touch, but you know, he was very busy too, and he couldn't. Neither one of us could do any better, and so there's no fault there. But it's just that it's difficult,
right?
It's difficult.
Of course,
this business is difficult on relationships, and there's just no question about it. And we all do our best, and that's all we can do. So in hindsight, I would say just go for it, because, that's what I wanted to do. In my yearbook, I said I wanted to travel. I wanted to sing, and I wanted to be happy. And so that's kind of been something that still moves me.
Yeah.
And
that
would be not being authentic to myself if I'd turned down the tour.
I know. Then you'd have to live with that for the rest of your life.
Well, and at the time, I hadn't worked for a year. And literally, I have to tell you this story. I was on... Not that I'm a super religious person or anything, but you know, I needed to make money.
Yeah.
And because I had not worked for a good year and a half at that point. And that very morning we were talking about, my husband and I were talking about something and that we might have to sell and get rid of and blah, blah, blah. And I remember going, oh God, if I could, any work, just send me any work, please. Any work, I'll take it. Any work, any work. And I got two calls, like by 1 o'clock in the afternoon. One from Matt Ryan in New York saying he wanted to see me for Fantine International Tour in New York. Could I hop on the next plane? And two, I was offered a job at the Citadel Theater in Edmonton, playing Hotel in Fiddler on the Roof. Just like that. Talk about prayers being answered.
Well,
can I just say that?
Well, no, but you said show business is tough on relationships. Show business can be tough on life.
Yes.
Like to be at that point where you're like, okay, I might have to make that choice now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then for it to just, you know, I hear that all the time. It's mm-hmm. very, very common. Hey, the other thing that I wanted to talk about, because I've talked to a couple of folks on the podcast who've been understudies, who've actually,
right.
That's what they're doing. And one of them was here at the Stratford Festival, and she's moved on to, next year she'll be in the ensemble. So that's great. It was mm-hmm. Bethany Kovarik. So you were the understudy in Kiss of the Spider Woman, which won Best Musical, Best Book, mm-hmm. Best Score, all these great Tony Awards. How long did you do that for?
I only did the Toronto production.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was asked to stay with the company all through England and New York. But at the time, my mom was in the last months of her life with cancer, and I could not go away for that long and not be near my mom.
Of course,
so when the company left Toronto, I left the company and went home and spent those last four months with my mom.
Yeah.
Not any amount of money in the world would take the place of those that time that I had with my mom before she passed, and the conversations that we had, and the so and I'd never understudied before. It was literally a four-minute role of Marta. And
so you're understudying a four-minute role.
Yeah.
And how was it emotionally, or like how did you, how was it just for your well-being to in terms of being rewarded? Like your, where did the rewards come in that kind of position, you know?
Well, for me in that position, in that particular situation, it was a brand new musical.
Right.
So to be in the room and watch Hal Prince direct this new piece and hear the, and the writers are sitting there and they say, oh no, we don't want this song. And they take it out and write another one. And the next day a new song would be there.
Yeah.
And
to
watching,
be a part of that.
Yes. Yeah, and to watching the actors adapt and change and grow and form and mold this incredible story was worth its weight in gold.
And I can't wait. I can't wait to see. So Footloose, fabulous. It's still on. People should go see it. And then Sister Act at the Dunfield Theatre, Cambridge, as well, which has had great reviews. And my buddy Lee Siegel, who was on the podcast a while ago. Yeah.
I love Lee. He's so
I can't wait to see the two of you. Yeah. I went to see him in Les Mis that they did at Drayton, but he had messed up his leg, so I didn't get to see him.
Oh, so he was out. I know, me too. I went to see it as well.
So disappointing.
I know, anyway. I know.
All right.
Well, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to remounting that. We did it in the spring, and so we're going to do it
again. Well, that's why I saw the great reviews and everything. Yeah, Well, this has been so much fun, Susan. Thank you so much for opening up about your life and everything. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me and for inviting me to do this.
Well, there you go, Susan Gilmore. Now, what's the takeaway? What's the one thing you think about after the interview? Don't fraternize with the staff on a cruise ship. Well, there's that. And the other one, of course, the most important thing for all actors out there is simply be in the moment. And, you know, you should have, I can't tell you when she was doing the Fantine for me, she just conjured up those moments. Boy, it was so impressive to see. Speaking of conjuring, did I ever mention that I used to do magic as a street performer in whole Montreal? It's true. Back then, I closed each show by reminding people to drop a few bills in the hat, you know, to help out. Well, you can do that digitally right now at theinadequatelife.com. Help support the show. I'd really appreciate it. Just visit theinadequatelife.com and visit support the show. I accept American money at par. That's, you know, the old street performing stuff. But seriously, and if you throw in, you can throw in whatever you want, $5, $10. But if you throw in, I think it's 30, you get some of Karen Hartwick's tea delivered to you in the mail, along with some stickers from The Inadequate Life. And I just heard from Maggie back in Austin, Texas. Her tea arrived and she's loving it. So thanks, Maggie, for that. Really appreciate it. Just visit theinadequatelife.com and click support the show. I'll be back in a bit with another episode of The Inadequate Life. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.